From the KTOO newsroom, I'm Claire Strempel. 2-year process that was stalling cleanup efforts at a mine upstream of Southeast Alaska has come to a close. As Coast Alaska's Angela Denning reports, that could speed up remediation at the Tulsiqua Chief Mine.
The Tulsiqua Chief Mine is in Canada, about 20 miles from the Alaska border near Juneau. It extracted zinc, copper, and lead in the 1950s, and ever since, rusty acidic runoff from the mine's tunnels and leftover waste rock has been flowing into a tributary of the Taku River, a major salmon-producing waterway.
For 65 years, it's been leaking acid mine drainage pretty much unabated into the watershed.
Guy Archibald is the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission. The group represents 15 tribes in the region concerned with toxic waste from Canada's mines. The British Columbia government has said it's committed to cleanup efforts, but in recent years, the process has been held up in court. In 2016, a company that had hoped to get the mine going again, Chieftain Metals, filed for bankruptcy and was put into receivership. That means a third-party firm, West Face Capital, was managing the mine's assets, hoping to recoup nearly $50 million of investments in the project. Eventually, a Canadian court gave the investors a 2-year deadline to ask for an extension on the receivership, and that ended August 11th. Archibald says it's a big step towards getting the mine cleaned up.
This is a long time coming, and I'm glad to see it.
West Face Capital did not return a request for comment. Though BC's mining ministry released a 113-page remediation plan and says it's performed some interim reclamation work the last 3 summers, environmental groups say the end of receivership will allow the BC government to take responsibility for the site and start a more substantial cleanup process. The government has been criticized for downplaying its environmental impact.
I think BC, sees this as a black mark, and they definitely want to get rid of it and prove that they can do the job right here.
Chris Zimmer is with Rivers Without Borders, an environmental watchdog group in Juneau that follows transboundary mining activity. He says BC can now move forward with cleanup.
The BC government for a couple years has been saying that this bankruptcy receivership process has hindered them, has tied their hands, has limited their abilities to actually get in there and physically clean up the mine and shut it down.
There are still a few steps before that can happen. Chieftain Metals must dissolve. An official with BC's Mine Division says that's expected to happen this fall. Zimmer says there is a long road ahead for remediation.
It's going to take a bit of time, certainly, to get the cleanup together and deal with the engineering challenges. So we're hoping to see BC right away start firming up its plans, creating budgets, and hopefully becoming a bit more transparent with us here in Alaska so we know what's going on.
The BC Ministry of Mines did not respond to requests for comment. Although Tulsiqua Chief Mine is small compared to other transboundary mines in Southeast and many that are proposed for development, Archibald says all eyes are on it.
It's kind of the poster child for, bad Canadian mining practices.
He says it could set a precedent for how the government deals with the industry. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
NASA scientists have completed another summer documenting climate change impacts in the far north. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Arctic Boreal Vulnerability Experiment, or ABOVE, employs a mix of techniques to track environmental impacts on over 2.5 million square miles in northern Alaska and northwestern Canada.
We like to say we're from leaf to orbit. We're looking at these changes going from people on the ground looking at the leaves all the way up to orbit using satellites.
NASA scientist Dr. Liz Hoy, an investigator with the Arctic Boreal Vulnerability Experiment, says impacts on everything from permafrost to vegetation and wildlife are being tracked.
We have over, 90 projects kind of all coming together to investigate this from kind of different angles and really trying to scale it up and understand it across this larger region.
Dr. Hoy says a major focus is on the effects of more intense and frequent wildfires.
And so then we're maybe not seeing the same kind of vegetation coming back. We're losing the thick organic soils that are keeping that, well insulated. We're losing some of the permafrost below it.
Gathering data from burn and other large areas of interest is facilitated by satellites and aircraft-mounted radar. Above systems engineer David Osterberry stands under a NASA-adapted Gulfstream jet carrying a $1 million synthetic aperture radar on its belly.
The radar pod itself kind of looks like a giant white torpedo. It's about 1,000 pounds, and it's mounted very solidly by this rack.
Osterberry says the radar unit sends a signal down to the earth, which bounces off the ground and back to the plane.
And we're digitizing that return at a high resolution in order to actually make an image of the ground itself. That actually is what enables the measurements of Earth surface variables, soil moisture, permafrost extent, active layer depth in some places, any number of variables that are relevant for the ecosystem vulnerability or resilience in the face of a changing climate.
We have these repeat measurements that are from 2017, 18, 19, and now 2022. So we're able to kind of look at how these areas are changing over time.
Dr. Hoy says remote sensing is complemented by ground-based field work. She points to rapid warming-caused changes being tracked right in Fairbanks along a boardwalk trail in the Creamers Field Refuge.
That boardwalk is all torn up now, and that area has really just subsided quite significantly because the permafrost has thawed, and that's been within the length of our campaign. We started sampling out there, you know, in 2017, and now the trees are kind of, I don't know, caving in, so it's like the drunken trees, and so it's really just changing quite significantly, and we see that in other areas as well.
3 years remain in the above project, and Hoy says the team hopes to return to Alaska to gather additional evidence of climate change. In Fairbanks, and Dan Bross.
Both the fall chum salmon and the coho salmon runs on the Yukon River remain too low to open subsistence harvest. State biologists do not expect either to reach their goals for fish reaching their spawning grounds. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
An estimated 3/4 of the fall chum salmon run is past the lower river. So far, the state-run sonar at Pilot Station has counted less than 200,000 fall chum. That's compared to a historical medium of nearly 500,000 fall chum by this time. The fall chum that have returned are slightly older than the historical average and with slightly fewer females than the historical average. The fall chum are also smaller, measuring 26 millimeters less than their historical average length. For Yukon River coho salmon, that run is also far below its average run size, but coming in higher numbers than last year's record low. The Pilot Station sonar has counted 43,000 coho compared to a historical average of 73,000 by this time. Like the fall chum, the coho are also returning smaller. The coho are averaging about 30 millimeters less than their historical average length. At Russian Mission, state biologists have attached radio tags to more than 100 coho. The Department of Fish and Game asks anyone catching a coho carrying a tag to call the department at 907-459-7274. That's 907-459-7274. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Senator Dan Sullivan is introducing legislation that goes after illegal Chinese fishing operations in federal waters off the coast of Alaska. Sullivan announced the Fighting for an Illegal Seafood Harvest Act, also known as the Fish Act, on a visit to Kodiak today. Sullivan says Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island helped author the bill.
This is a very bipartisan bill and a very needed bill.
The Fish Act directs the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to compile a blacklist of foreign vessels that have engaged in unsanctioned fishing and ban them from U.S. ports. It also beefs up the Coast Guard's ability to inspect foreign ships, and it calls for more regular reports to Congress on illegal fishing activities. The legislation cites all foreign ships, but Sullivan says it specifically addresses current transgressions by Chinese boats in federal and international waters. He says it was drafted with input from NOAA and officials from the Coast Guard and has broad support in Washington, D.C.
Senators who are very hawkish against China are focused on this. People who want to keep our fisheries strong and sustainable are focused on this. This unites kind of all different stakeholder groups.
Sullivan and Senator Lisa Murkowski were in Kodiak for a meeting with fisheries managers and officials from NOAA. Members of Congress are currently on summer recess, and there is no timeline to vote on the bill. Scattered showers today and tonight. The high is near 65 with a low of 53. You're listening to KTOO.